14. The first day. The cold gripped harder as night fell. Snow that had thawed in sunlight froze as slick ice. Concealed on nearby roofs or in attics, the Gaul shot over their pitch-tipped arrows that arched red and gold like birds of fire through the cold twilight air. The roofs of the four beleaguered buildings were of copper, the walls of stone. No fire caught. The attacks on the barricade ceased. No more arrows of iron or fire were shot. Standing up on the barricade, Yakob Bagat saw the darkening street slant off, empty, between dark houses. At first the men in the square waited for a night attack, for the Gaul were plainly desperate. But it grew colder and still colder. At last, Agat ordered that only the minimum watch be kept, and let most of the men go to have their wounds looked after, and get food and rest. If they were exhausted, so must the Gaul be. And they, at least, were clothed against this cold, while the Gaul were not. Even desperation would not drive the northerners out into this awful starlit clarity, in their scant rags of fur and felt. So the defenders slept, many at their posts, huddled in the halls and by the windows of warm buildings. And the besiegers, without food, pressed around campfires built in high stone rooms, and their dead lay stiff-limbed in the ice-crusted snow below the barricades. Agat wanted no sleep. He could not go inside the buildings, leaving the square where all day long they had fought for their lives, and which now lay so still under the winter constellations, the tree and the arrow and the track of five stars, and the snow star itself, fiery above the eastern roofs. The stars of winter. They burned like crystals in the profound cold blackness overhead. He knew this was the last night. His own last night, or his city's, or the last night of battle, which one he did not know. As the hours wore on and the snow star rose higher, an utter silence held the square and the streets around it. A kind of exultation got hold of him. They slept, all the enemies within these city walls, and it was as if he alone waked, as if the city belonged, with all its sleepers and all its dead, to him alone. This was his night. He would not spend it locked in a trap within a trap. With a word to the sleepy guard, he mounted the Esmet Street barricade and swung himself down on the other side. "Altera!" someone called after him in a hoarse whisper. He only turned and gestured that they keep a rope ready for him to get back up on, and went on, right up the middle of the street. He had a conviction of his invulnerability with which it would be bad luck to argue. He accepted it, and walked up the dark street among his enemies, as if he were taking a stroll after dinner. He passed his house, but did not turn aside. Stars eclipsed behind the black roof peaks, and reappeared, their reflections glittering in the ice underfoot. Near the upper end of town, the street narrowed and turned a little between houses that had been deserted since before Agat was born, and then opened out suddenly into the little square under the land gate. The catapults still stood there, partly wrecked and dismantled for firewood by the Gaul, each with a heap of stones beside it. The high gates themselves had been opened at one point, but were bolted again now, and frozen fast. Agat climbed up the steps beside one of the gate towers to a post on the wall. He remembered looking down from that post, just before the snow began, on the whole battle force of the Gaul, a roaring tide of men like the sea tide down on the beach. If they had had more ladders, it would have been all over with that day. Now nothing moved, nothing made any sound. Snow, silence, starlight over the slope, and the dead ice-laden trees that crowned it. He looked back westward, over the whole city of exile, a little clutter of roofs dropping down away from his high post to the wall over the sea cliff. Above that handful of stone, the stars moved slowly westward. Agat sat motionless, cold even in his clothing of leather and heavy furs, whistling a jig tune very softly. Finally, he felt the day's weariness catching up with him, and descended from his perch. The steps were icy. He slipped on the next to bottom step, caught himself from falling by grabbing the rough stone of the wall, and then, still staggering, looked up at some movement that had caught his eyes across the little square. In the black gulf of a street opening between two house walls, something white moved, a slight swaying motion like a wave seen in the dark. Agat stared, puzzled. Then it came out into the vague gray of the starlight, a tall, thin, white figure running towards him very quickly as a man runs, the head on the long, curving neck swaying a little from side to side. As it came, it made a little wheezing, chirping sound. His dart gun had been in his hand all along, but his hand was stiff from yesterday's wound, and the glove hampered him. He shot, and the dart struck, but the creature was already on him, the short, clawed forearms reaching out, the head stuck forward with its weaving, swaying motion, a round-toothed mouth gaping open. He threw himself down right against its legs in an effort to trip it and escape the first lunge of that snapping mouth, but it was quicker than he. Even as he went down, it turned and caught at him, and he felt the claws on the weak-looking little arms tear through the leather of his coat and clothing and felt himself pinned down. A terrible strength bent his head back, baring his throat, and he saw the stars whirl in the sky far up above him and go out. And then he was trying to pull himself up on hands and knees, on the icy stones beside a great reeking bulk of white fur that twitched and trembled. 5 seconds it took the poison on the dart tip to act. It had almost been a second too long. The round mouth still snapped open and shut, and the legs with their flat, splayed snowshoe feet pumped, as if the snow ghoul were still running. Snow ghouls hunt in packs, Agat's memory said suddenly, as he stood trying to get his breath and nerve back. Snow ghouls hunt in packs. He reloaded his gun clumsily but methodically, and with it held ready, started back down Esmet Street, not running lest he slip on the ice, but not strolling either. The street was still empty and serene and very long. But as he neared the barricade, he was whistling again. He was sound asleep in the room in the college when young Shevik, their best archer, came to rouse him, whispering urgently, "Come on, Altera, come on, wake up, you've got to come." Rollery had not come in during the night. The others who shared the room were all still asleep. "What is it? What's wrong?" Agat mumbled, on his feet and struggling into his torn coat already. "Come on to the tower," was all Shevik said. Agat followed him, at first with docility, then waking up fully, with beginning understanding. They crossed the square, gray in the first bleak light, ran up the circular stairs of the League Tower, and looked out over the city. The land gate was open. The Gaul were gathered inside it, and going out of it. It was hard to see them in the half-light before sunrise. There were between 1,000 and 2,000 of them, the men watching with Agat guessed, but it was hard to tell. They were only shadowy blots of motion under the walls and on the snow. They strung out from the gate in knots and groups, one after another disappearing under the walls and then reappearing farther away on the hillside, going at a jog trot in a long, irregular line, going south. Before they had gone far, the dim light and the folds of the hill hid them. But before Agat stopped watching, the east had grown bright, and a cold radiance reached halfway up the sky. The houses and the steep streets of the city lay very quiet in the morning light. Somebody began to ring the bell, right over their heads in the tower there, a steady, rapid clamor and clangor of bronze on bronze, bewildering. Hands over their ears, the men in the tower came running down, meeting other men and women halfway. They laughed and they shouted after Agat and caught at him, but he ran on down the rocking stairs, the insistent jubilation of the bell still hammering at him, and into the League Hall. in the big, crowded, noisy room where golden sun swam on the walls and the years and years were told on golden dials, he searched for the alien, the stranger, his wife. He finally found her, and taking her hands, he said, "They're gone, they're gone, they're gone." Then he turned and roared it with all the force of his lungs at everybody. "They're gone!" They were all roaring at him and at one another, laughing and crying. After a minute, he said to Rollery, "Come on with me, out to the stack." Restless, exultant, bewildered, he wanted to be on the move, to get out into the city and make sure it was their own again. No one else had left the square yet, and as they crossed the west barricade, Agat drew his dart gun. "I had an adventure last night," he said to Rollery. And she, looking at the gaping rent in his coat, said, "I know. I killed it."
"A snow ghoul?"
"Right."
"Alone?"
"Yes. Both of us, fortunately." The solemn look on her face as she hurried along beside him made him laugh out loud with pleasure. They came out onto the causeway, running out in the icy wind between the bright sky and the dark, foam-laced water. The news, of course, had already been given by the bell and by mind speech, and the drawbridge of the stack was lowered as soon as Agat set foot on the bridge. Men and women and little sleepy, fur-bundled children came running to meet them with more shouts, questions, and embraces. Behind the women of Landin, the women of Tavar hung back, afraid and unrejoicing. Agat saw Rollery going to one of these, a young woman with wild hair and dirt-smudged face. Most of them had hacked their hair short and looked unkempt and filthy, even the few Hilf men who had stayed out at the stack. A little disgusted by this grimy spot on his bright morning of victory, Agat spoke to Amoximan, who had come out to gather his tribesmen together. They stood on the drawbridge under the sheer wall of the Black Fort. Hilf men and women had collected around Amoximan, and Agat lifted up his voice so they all could hear. "The men of Tavar kept our walls side by side with the men of Landin. They are welcome to stay with us or to go, to live with us or leave us as they please. The gates of my city are open to you all winter long. You are free to go out them, but welcome within them." "I hear," the native said, bowing his fair head. "But where's the eldest, Wold? I wanted to tell him." Then Agat saw the ash-smeared faces and ragged heads with a new eye. They were in mourning. In understanding that, he remembered his own dead, his friends, his kinsmen, and the arrogance of triumph went out of him. Amoximan said, "The eldest of my kin went under the sea with his sons who died in Tavar. Yesterday he went. They were building the dawn fire when they heard the bell and saw the Gaal going south." "I would watch this fire," Agat said, asking Umaksaman's permission. The Tavaran hesitated, but an older man beside him said firmly, "Wold's daughter is this one's wife. He has clan right." So they let him come, with Rollery and all that were left of her people, to a high terrace outside a gallery on the seaward side of the stack. There, on a pyre of broken wood, the body of the old man lay, age deformed and powerful, wrapped in a red cloth, death's color. A young child set the torch, and the fire burnt red and yellow, shaking the air, paled by the cold early light of the sun. The tide was drawing out, grinding and thundering at the rocks below the sheer black walls. East, over the hills of Askatavar Range, and west over the sea, the sky was clear, but northward, a bluish dusk brooded. Winter. 5,000 nights of winter, 5,000 days of it. The rest of their youth, and maybe the rest of their lives. Against that distant bluish darkness in the north, no triumph showed up at all. The Gaal seemed a little scurry of vermin, gone already, fleeing before the true enemy, the true lord, the white lord of the storms. Agat stood by Rollery in front of the sinking death fire, in the high, sea-beleaguered fort, and it seemed to him then that the old man's death and the young man's victory were the same thing. Neither grief nor pride had so much truth in them as did joy. The joy that trembled in the cold wind between sky and sea, bright and brief as fire. This was his fort, his city, his world. These were his people. He was no exile here. "Come," he said to Rollory as the fire sank down to ashes. "Come, let's go home."
This concludes the reading of Planet of Exile by Ursula K. Le Guin. Copyright 1966 by Ursula K. Le Guin. This book was read by Stephen Hoy and Carrington McDuffie. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Skyboat Road Company, Inc., and was produced in 2007 by Skyboat Road Company, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Skyboat Road Company, Inc. or Blackstone Audio, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.